Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Julia Barnes. She's an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's the director of Sea of Life and Bright Green Lies. Her current work focuses on opposing deep-sea mining. She's co-founder of Deep Sea Defenders, found at deepseadefenders.org, deepseadefenders.org. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what is deep sea mining, and why is it even being considered to take place?
Yeah, deep sea mining is this crazy idea that they have to extract metals and minerals from the deep ocean. And there are a lot of different forms that this could potentially take, because there are a lot of different types of habitats in the deep ocean. So they're considering things like mining hydrothermal vents and mining cobalt-rich crusts and all sorts of different things. But the main form of deep sea mining that is being pursued right now, and the form that I've mostly been focused on opposing, is the mining of things called polymetallic nodules from the abyssal plains regions of the ocean. Particularly, the area that they're targeting right now is located in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is an area between Hawaii and Mexico. And polymetallic nodules are these things that are really important to the functioning of the deep sea. They are little formations that kind of look like rocks. They're pretty much black in color, and they are usually very, very old. They can be up to 500 million years old. They grow at a rate of 10 millimeters per million years, and they basically form around a bit of debris on the seafloor. Something like shark teeth can start off the process of making a polymetallic nodule. And what happens is metals very slowly amalgamate around this fragment of debris. So when you cut a polymetallic nodule in half, you can see growth rings, like the growth rings on a tree, like just concentric circles of how the metals have amalgamated around them. And polymetallic nodules are very porous. They have about 60% porosity. They have the equivalent of like 2 football fields worth of surface area inside them. And in that surface area lives an incredible community of microbes. And there's a much more dense and much more diverse community of microbes living inside polymetallic nodules than what exists in the surrounding sediment or seawater. And what these microbes do, and what the polymetallic nodules do as like a kind of mini community, they help to regulate the conditions in the seawater around them. So there's an exchange of nutrients between the nodules and the water around them. They help to balance the acidity of the water. And the microbes, using some metals from the nodules and through a redox reaction, they pull carbon out of the water around them and help to lock that away in the sediment beneath the nodules. So these polymetallic nodules are the things that companies are targeting for mining. And, you know, they're really important in terms of the role that they play with the microbes, but also just as habitat. Because the sediment in the abyssal plains regions of the ocean, it's very mucky and, it's not something that creatures can necessarily establish a home on. So the polymetallic nodules are often the only hard substrate that things like corals and sponges can attach to. They're also breeding ground for a lot of different species. So they're just really important for the whole functioning of the deep sea community. And what they're planning to do with this mining is to send huge machines down into the abyssal plains regions of the ocean. These are machines that would be 40 feet by 20 feet by 16 feet. They've been called house-sized machines. So they're pretty enormous. They would move along the seabed and extract as many of these polymetallic nodules as they can. By doing this, they're going to destroy essentially every living thing in their path. And a lot of the creatures in the deep sea are not mobile. They can't just pick up and get out of the way of these mining machines. So there's the obvious problem of habitat destruction. The next step in the process for mining is that they would crush the nodules at depth. That's what they're planning on doing to make it a little bit easier for them to send these materials up through riser pipes to a ship that is waiting on the sea surface. And so the material would be pumped thousands of meters up to a ship on the surface. These pumps also create a lot of noise, and the mining process and also the functioning of the machines just in general create a lot of noise. So there's kind of new papers that are coming out lately about the potential impacts this would have on whales. And, you know, whales are very much dependent on sound for communication as the way that they see and perceive the world around them. And this is something that they're thinking could have a big impact on the behavior of cetaceans and could be really detrimental for them as the noise pollution from this industry. So once the material reaches the ship on the surface, they would have to do some initial processing to separate the materials that they want, the crushed up polymetallic nodules, from the sediment and whatever other debris that they have brought up with it. And
wait, how do they collect the nodules? Is it like a giant vacuum cleaner, or is it a someone that picks them up one at a time?
More like a vacuum cleaner. I have heard it described that way. But they also, there's some plans to use like jets of water to try and loosen the nodules from the sediment. So it's a bit more complex than just suction, but yeah, essentially vacuum type of thing. Yeah. So a big problem, another huge problem, is the waste that would be discharged from this mining process. And it is estimated that every single day that they're in operation, and these would be running, you know, 24 hours a day, the mining process would be going on. Every day, 2 to 6 million cubic feet of sediment would be created and, well, not created, but I guess brought to the surface and have to be put back somewhere. So they're planning to pump this down to a certain depth in the ocean, probably somewhere in the midwater zone. So they're not pumping it all the way back down to the deep ocean, much closer to the surface in the grand scheme of the different depths of the ocean. And it would be equivalent to like every day each mining vessel, and, you know, if deep sea mining really takes off as an industry, there could be tens of mining vessels operating at a time. Each one would be producing something like 22,000 dump trucks worth of sediment and dumping that back into the ocean, polluting the ocean with huge plumes of sediment. Now, this is fine particulate matter. It's essentially what is created when marine fall sinks to the bottom of the ocean and different organisms work on decomposing it. And so it's not sand. Like, some of the modeling that's been done kind of by industry or on behalf of industry has used sand as a modeling substance, which sinks a lot faster. But this, the sediment that would be brought up from the abyssal plains region of the deep sea does not behave like sand. It is very light, and it would stay suspended for potentially months or years at a time. And it's something that would be just catastrophic for any species who breathes underwater, because it gets into the gills of fish and essentially suffocates them. So we could see potentially huge plumes of sediment that get released into the ocean and are carried and spread through currents in the ocean. And they can get hundreds of kilometers away from the mining site. They can spread out and just impacts an absolutely enormous area of the ocean. So those are some of the big concerns with deep sea mining and how it would affect the species who live in the deep sea. Also, I mean, I didn't mention it, but of course there would be plumes created at depth as well as these mining machines are moving along the bottom of the ocean and as they are stirring up sediments down there. So even if a creature is not directly in the path of a mining machine, things like sponges who are filter feeders, they're going to get clogged up by the sediment that is created. And a lot of species who, for example, aren't very mobile would could potentially be smothered by these plumes of sediment that are created at depth as the plumes kind of pick up and spread and settle in different places.
Thank you for all that. And can you back up for a second and talk about a little bit more about what that is it called the abyssal plain? Is that what you called it?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about what it's like? So you mentioned the nodules themselves and the natural communities that form around them, and who else? And then you mentioned sponges. Who else lives down there? And also, you may have said this, but I forgot. How deep is this? And just tell us a little bit more about the ecotype before we go back to the mining.
Okay, yeah. So the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, where they're targeting for mining, is about 5,500 meters deep. And the communities who live there are just some of the most beautiful and incredible species, and a huge variety. I mean, the mining companies, what they've done in the past in their kind of marketing of their activities has been to describe these regions as essentially deserts, lifeless deserts. So don't worry, nothing lives there, or it's just very small organisms that nobody should be concerned about. But the reality is there are loads and loads of different species who live there who are just incredible, and all different sizes of species. I mean, so there's kind of all the creatures that you would tend to think about living in the ocean. There are octopuses, there are corals, there are sponges, worms, crabs, eels, sharks, urchins, starfish, different types of fish, jellies and squids, and, you know, just all sorts of different animals. And then, but what's different is that so many of the species in the deep sea just look really different than what we tend to expect. Like, you'll see pink octopuses with really big eyes, or you'll see creatures who have bioluminescence. A lot of them utilize bioluminescence. They create their own light to communicate with each other, to attract prey or evade predators. There are just weird adaptations. Like, you see creatures with really large mouths and very sharp, pointy, long teeth, and sharks that are really amazing. Like, my favorite shark in the deep sea is called the frilled shark. And it's a shark who has a really long body and kind of looks a lot like an eel in the body, but has a face that looks kind of similar to a snake, and big eyes that are almost this like glowing green color. And yeah, I just think they're the most beautiful thing. But there's like really cute creatures like sea angels, and they look like tiny little angels, and they're kind of gelatinous. There are, what are some of the weirdest ones? The giant larvacean, which I hope that people who are listening to this will look up images or videos of the creatures who live in the deep sea, because I can't really do a good enough job describing them, but just when you see them, I think people can't help but fall in love with them and kind of be fascinated with them. There's also a lot of translucent species. The glass octopus is a really cool one. Yeah, there's all sorts, but yeah, you really have to see them.
And also, I know this is off the subject, but I believe that I read about or saw a video or something many, many years ago of the manganese nodules or the the nodules on the seafloor, and they seem to be rolling around. So is the seafloor a little bit hard? Are they capable of rolling around, or is it like you use the word muck? Is it more like mud doesn't really work, but is it more what's the actual surface like? Do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, so the pictures and the videos that I've seen, it more behaves like muck. It's not a hard surface. It's a bit like mud, I guess. Like really, really wet mud that if you stepped in it, your foot would just sink in. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Okay, great. So let's go back to the mining. Why are they considering mining this? What would the minerals be used for?
So the minerals that they're after in polymetallic nodules are copper, cobalt, nickel, and manganese. And the companies that are trying to mine the deep sea often talk about it as that these are necessary for batteries for electric vehicles and energy storage from the so-called renewable energy sources. And they really like to promote the deep sea mining industry as, we have to do this. There's not enough minerals on land. And if we're going to have a clean energy transition, we have to get our battery minerals from the deep sea. And, you know, because this is necessary, then this is a green form of mining and, you know, nobody can really be against it. And, you know, I don't know that it's true that the minerals would be used in batteries for electric vehicles. I mean, to me, it doesn't matter where they end up. Like, deep sea mining is not something that should happen. But I just think the story that it's that this is all for green technology is something that, yes, the industry has grabbed onto because it benefits them. It's a great talking point for them. But ultimately, they're going to sell these metals to whoever is willing to buy them. And they could just as easily be used in batteries for cell phones or laptops or any kind of electronic gadget. It looks like the main target use for them would be batteries of some sort.
So, yeah, I agree that that's a really good talking point. We need to kill the oceans to save the planet.
Well, yeah, it's a bit absurd, isn't it? And, you know, obviously not everybody's falling for that, but some investors certainly have. And, you know, if they can put themselves out as, oh, yeah, we're like an ESG company and you should invest in us. It has been working for them to some extent, but also obviously a lot of people have caught on to the fact that, yeah, this is greenwashing and no, destroying the ocean is not a good idea for the planet. And the other thing that's really funny is that they are so into promoting this as a climate solution. But, you know, what I haven't mentioned yet about the deep sea is that actually the deep sea is the largest active carbon sink on the planet. And in mining for polymetallic nodules, it would be not only it would be stirring up and releasing carbon that is right now in a stable form, releasing that back into the seawater and increasing the acidity. Like, ocean acidification is obviously a really big problem. And we could see this huge acceleration of ocean acidification in the deep sea, but also they're disturbing this huge carbon sink. And there's a lot of concern that this would permanently damage the ability of the deep sea to sequester carbon. And, you know, instead of being a carbon sink, yeah, now it can't function that way anymore because of the mining, particularly given that the polymetallic nodules that they're taking out play such an important role in the carbon cycle in the deep sea. Something that could, you know, this could be one of the worst things you could do for the climate. So it's quite ironic that they're, trying to portray themselves as climate saviors when they're messing with something that I don't think they even know how bad the impacts could be.
So I want to talk more about that in a minute, but I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is they grow, did you say like 10 millimeters in a million years?
Yeah, exactly.
And how big would a nodule be?
So they've been called potato-sized, but their size varies a lot. So you can find polymetallic nodules that are like the size of little pebbles. You can find bigger ones, maybe the size of a baseball. But yeah, that's the general size range.
Okay, so just a second. So a baseball, what's a baseball? Baseball, let's say it's, people are going to laugh because I'm going to be so wrong, but let's say 3 inches across. And 3 inches across is 2.5, 7.5 centimeters. So that's 75 millimeters, 10 millimeters per million years. So that one would be between 5 and 10 million years old, right? So my point is that, go ahead.
I know some of them have been dated to 500 million years old. So that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? So either. Some of them can be much bigger, but maybe the growth rate changes over time.
Yeah. So that the 500 million years makes the point even more that if you know, I feel bad when somebody like when some ancient ruin gets destroyed, or ancient ruin's the wrong word, when some ancient artifact gets destroyed, if somebody were to, just for the heck of it, you know, take down a cathedral that was built 800 years ago, if something lasts 800 years, I think, you know, you should let it go. You shouldn't take it down to use the bricks to, you know, make a patio. And these nodules have been around. I mean, the individual nodules, some of them have been around since before the dinosaurs then. I mean, my point is, yes, there's all this saving the natural community, I think, is really important. And then there's also, I think we should just have some respect for the sheer age. I mean, those are communities who have lived for, you know, like you know, 50 million years or however, 500 million years. I mean, there's something to be said for that too.
Yes, I think we should respect them as beings. Like, you know, the mining industry likes to call them batteries in a rock. And, you know, when you say rocks, like, people generally don't care about rocks. But yeah, these are very much alive and they have communities in them. And I suppose the history of these communities goes back many millions of years if they have, if those bacteria's lineages have existed that long. So yeah, I think they're much more than just this lifeless object that the mining companies are treating them as, and we should almost think of them like the trees in an old growth forest or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. So this is the area you're focused on. Are there other plans for other deep sea mining in other places?
There are, and you know, I don't know too much about them, but yes, there's plans to mine hydrothermal vents, and there are plans to mine cobalt crusts. And those are the two other main types, although I think there's a few other types as well. But those are a lot further away from actually happening, I think. Although one of the original places that was targeted for deep sea mining was Papua New Guinea. And they were planning on mining hydrothermal vents off of Papua New Guinea. And this would have been within the exclusive economic zone of that country, so not falling under the regulations of the high seas. And this was like a decade ago, and the company that was trying to do it ultimately went bankrupt. But I think recently the permits, those mining permits, have been acquired by another company. So that could be an issue that becomes more urgent again pretty soon. So there's definitely other, and when that company, it was called Nautilus, was getting ready to do mining of hydrothermal vents off of Papua New Guinea, they did some test mining, and the people who were living there noticed that the water turned murky and there were weird creatures washing up on shore that they had never seen before. So, yeah, I mean, all of these other forms of deep sea mining are going to be hugely destructive and almost, I don't want to say more so because you can't really compare them one for one, but the abyssal plains, I think, has been an easy sell for the mining industry because they can show pictures of areas that are relatively, like, you don't see a lot of creatures per square foot. And so they can show a picture and be like, yeah, it's a lifeless desert, nothing lives there. But hydrothermal vents are just bursting with life. And there's so many, like, really creatures who are really specially adapted to those circumstances, like to the conditions of this extremely hot water that's coming out of a hydrothermal vent. And they're just something that looks absolutely beautiful. And people, I think, are more outraged by forms of mining like that, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we haven't seen the push for mining hydrothermal vents as, you know, they're kind of using the abyssal plains as the gateway to deep sea mining. Like, it's a bit of an easier sell.
And aren't there some theories that the hydrothermal vents might be the source of life on Earth? I mean, like where life started. I mean, we talk about the nodules being old, but the deep sea vents are even older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to go back to the arguments for mining, and one of the things I've seen in the mainstream press, and this is the sort of thing that just makes me very upset at journalists, is a lot of the articles I've seen say, well, some sacrifices need to be made if we're going to save the Earth. And two problems. One is, what they really mean is power the industrial economy. They don't mean save the Earth. And the second is that whenever they talk like this, the sacrifices that are to be made are always by wild nature or poor humans on some cases. But in this case, it's the sacrifices are wild nature. And that's not actually, and they'll use the word dilemma, but a dilemma is when, you know, I'm either going to lose my, you know, either I'm going to get a worse infection or they're going to cut off my pinky. That's a dilemma. It's not a dilemma when you're forcing the cost onto somebody else. That's just forcing the cost onto somebody else. And in this case, the cost will be paid by the abyssal plane.
Yes. And they're not mining the ocean to save the planet. They're mining the ocean to produce electric vehicles, which are essentially a luxury item for, you know, a very few people who can afford them. And I had a train of thought and I totally lost it. sacrifice the electric car. Don't sacrifice the ocean. Like, what is on the table to be sacrificed is, it's not our luxuries, it's life on the planet, which just makes absolutely no sense. It's just a continuation of this whole insane, way of life that has led to the problem that we're in. It's not a solution to the problems.
So a couple days ago, you sent me an article and you mentioned that there are some, I don't know what word we use, shenanigans. There are that there is some dishonesty taking place. Well, we know there's dishonesty, but there's even more dishonesty taking place in the discussion. Can you talk about the sampling dishonesty? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. So, yeah, and people can look this up. So it was a joint press release from the Deep Sea Mining Campaign, Mining Watch Canada, and Greenpeace International. And it was looking at, there was some test mining done by a company called TMC, the metals company. Actually, no, it was done by a subsidiary of theirs called NORI, because, yeah, they're running a lot through this subsidiary right now, which is based out of Nauru, the country that they kind of partnered with. But anyway, they were testing their equipment. They actually ended up during this test pulling up 3,000 tons of nodules. And it looked like kind of this huge mound of nodules in a ship. And the CEO guy is there like drinking champagne in front of it. Oh, great. We've, you know, dug this all up from the ocean. But anyway, yeah, during this test, there was a leak of some, we'll call it sediment wastewater. The company later, when they were talking about this, they just said, oh, yeah, some water spilled into the ocean. But in the videos, you can see very clearly that it's dark brown in color. It's like, no, it's not just seawater. But yeah, they've been very clever in trying to kind of sweep that one under the table. But they had some kind of malfunction where a bunch of the sediment spilled into the water, just like right off the boat. But another thing that happened is some scientists anonymously came forward with the information that, I'm just going to read directly from the a little quote from the press release that talks about what happened. Testimonies from scientists responsible for monitoring the tests and gathering scientific data calls into question the scientific integrity of TMC and Allseas. According to these scientists, inappropriate instrumentation was used to measure the sediment plumes generated by the deep sea mining operation, and the test methodology was not informed by plume physics. Sediment plumes will be a key environmental impact of this extractive industry due to their potential to smother and poison life forms over a wide area, both horizontally and vertically in the water column. In addition, scientists allege that attempts were made to influence the independence of sampling activities. For example, according to these reports, scientists have been asked to take plume samples in clear water outside the plume's path. And so these scientists who were on board have basically said that any data that comes out of this experimental mining will be meaningless. But that data is going to be the key information that the industry relies on and that the International Seabed Authority relies on in making determinations about what the impacts are of deep sea mining. And so, yeah, that's, I don't know, I thought pretty horrific. And I mean, yeah, probably not surprising when you've got the company involved in the supposed scientific research.
So just to be clear, when they're testing for the sediment, they told them to test where the sediment isn't. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what they're saying. I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Take your sample of the sediment over there where there is no sediment. Yep.
Well, that works well.
Mm-hmm. Works out really great for them, doesn't it?
So thank you for this introduction. And we have about 10 to 15 minutes left. And can you bring us up to date on some of the latest things that are going on with this, apart from the sampling outside of sampling areas?
Sure. So the International Seabed Authority, which is the regulatory body for mining in international waters, met recently, and the kind of 2-week meeting has just concluded. And they are planning to, on July 9th of this year, start accepting applications for commercial mining permits. Now, there is no mining code in place yet. There are some draft regulations, but probably those won't be agreed upon anytime soon. I don't think we're anywhere close to seeing that happen. And the ISA is undecided at this point as to whether or not they're going to start permitting mining. But the two-year rule, which was triggered by Nauru almost 2 years ago, is going to, you know, come up in this June or July, pretty much makes it an obligation for them to provisionally approve mining applications. It was just this weird clause in the international laws of the sea that said that they had to either finalize their mining regulations within 2 years or else potentially provisionally approve, let these companies go mine the deep sea with no regulations in place.
That's like 100% the opposite of the precautionary principle, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. And I don't know if they're actually going to let them or not. Like, it's yet to be seen. Gosh, really hope they don't, but it's the ISA, and I don't know. We'll see what happens, but I don't know. We can't wait to see what happens. Like, this needs to be stopped. I wish I knew what could actually be done to stop this. So that's something that's been going on. And a lot of people got very excited about the High Seas Treaty, and there were a lot of NGOs claiming that it would put limits on deep sea mining. So I probably just want to take a second and say, no, it doesn't. Like, the 54-page document is available online. Anybody can read that. And it's not there to regulate deep sea mining. And it even explicitly excludes deep sea mining from the environmental impact assessment section of the High Seas Treaty. So there's that. I don't know. What else is there for updates?
Well, I'm sure you aren't too, but I'm not comfortable with the idea of regulating deep sea mining. I think it should be
exactly. It doesn't matter what regulations there are. It shouldn't happen. Like, just end of story. This should not happen. But obviously, yeah, if you have no regulations, I guess it's just slightly that much worse in that they could be dumping the plumes right at the surface. They could be dumping the sediment right at the surface. They could essentially do anything they want. But yeah, no, I mean, it's not like it's okay if there's regulations like this. Yeah, it's just, let's have a complete ban on deep sea mining worldwide, please.
So go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
So you've talked about this a little bit, but I'm sorry, I'm still a little unclear. What is the governing body for this? How does it work? I'm a little bit unclear as to, once you leave territorial waters, who's in charge?
Okay, so when it comes to the seabed, it's the International Seabed Authority. So the high seas is any area outside of a country's exclusive economic zone. And the exclusive economic zone goes like 200 nautical miles from the coast. So really large portion of the world and of the ocean is considered the high seas. So the seabed is specifically governed by the International Seabed Authority. It is a organization that was created by the UN. So it's kind of related to the UN, and it is based in Jamaica. It has all the same countries who are members of UNCLOS, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So it's 167 countries plus the EU make up the membership of it. And when it was created, it had two mandates. One of them was to protect the environment of the international seabed, and the other one was to facilitate mining. So kind of a conflict there. The ISA a lot of the decision making comes from the legal and technical committee. So that has about 30 members, and I think it's mostly lawyers and people from industry. What's interesting is that, okay, people have called for there to be like some kind of scientific body within the International Seabed Authority. And what they have is a legal and technical committee. Now, within the High Seas Treaty, which was recently introduced, if you want to establish a marine protected area on the high seas, you have to pass it through the scientific and technical committee. So there's you have to go through a scientific process if you want to create a marine protected area. But with the International Seabed Authority, with going ahead with mining, it's a legal and technical committee. Which
right.
Never mind the impacts on the environment. But essentially, like 30 people have a tremendous amount of power over what takes place in this huge area of the planet that is just so important to all life on the planet. And they have never turned down a company for that is applying for an exploration permit. And the way that the ISA is structured, its funding will come from mining royalties. So, yeah, they've come under a lot of like criticism, but they are the regulatory body for this. I don't think they should be, but that's what there is. And
I don't see why there would be a problem with an organization that seems to be completely unaccountable and that grants every permit that it gets a request for.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
So if there is a thing that an environmental thing that is happening here in this county that I don't like, I can appeal to the county. I can take them to court through either the county or the state or the federal system, depending on where it is. And, you know, let's say it's a huge case. It could go to the state Supreme Court or the United States Supreme Court, who would ultimately decide. And I might get screwed over at that level. Or for a Forest Service thing, I can start by appealing to the Forest Service. And then after that, I can take them to court in federal court. And go that direction. If you want to fight this organization because it's part of the UN like that, who has ultimate authority over it? Is there any court that could say, no, you can't issue that permit?
Okay, so I have been trying to answer that question for probably a year, and I've talked with lawyers about this, and nobody seems to have an answer or no, like, because it's an area beyond national jurisdiction, it's like, yeah, what is the jurisdiction that you could sue them for this or try and bring some kind of legal I've looked into doing this, like with Deep Sea Defenders. That was something we wanted to, you know, see if we could pursue some kind of legal challenge, and really didn't find any answers. So if there's a lawyer who's listening to this who thinks they know, please get in contact with me. I don't know that there is anything you can do, which is quite terrifying.
I hope you say something else, because I don't even have a follow-up question to that.
I don't know what else to say, really.
I mean, okay, so let me know if I'm understanding this correctly. There is this process which could be tremendously profitable, especially with subsidies, that is also remarkably destructive and will take place over large areas, and the governing body is we can't figure out to whom they are accountable, and they have to this point granted every permit that they for which someone has applied. And if by July they don't establish another set of rules, then that means that every permit will be automatically accepted. Am I basically understanding this? What?
Well, potentially. I mean, the ISA could choose to not accept the permits, but they are kind of under an obligation to do so. So, I mean, we don't know whether or not they will, but it's pretty likely, yeah.
So I guess my question is, what could possibly go wrong with a situation like that?
I mean, it is that bad. Like, yeah, I mean, this is why it's such a difficult thing. It's such a difficult thing to be trying to stop deep sea mining, because, you know, on top of all the issues with like the legal and not, you know, being able to necessarily do anything in that area, it's something that will be taking place in an area that is so remote. You can't get there to do direct action to try and stop this from happening. And it's the middle of the ocean, and it's out of sight and out of mind for a lot of people. And I mean, I don't think I mentioned yet in this interview, but the size of the area that they want to mine, if all of the permits that have just been granted for exploration permits, if they all turn over into exploitation permits, it will be an area as wide as North America in the ocean just being obliterated. Like, and the distance that the plumes from that will travel. It's all very horrifying. I mean, luckily, like, oh, I don't know, this does to generally horrify the people who hear about it, but then we're all kind of left like, yeah, how do we stop this? And how do we stop it in time? It is coming so quickly that this all could be going on. And it kind of just makes you want to cry, doesn't it? I don't know. Yeah.
So in addition to all these other problems, I mean, you pretty much just said this, but I want to just make it explicit that, you know, a lot of good is done environmentally by NIMBYs, not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew he died a couple years ago, but there was this great, great activist in North Idaho who was a back to the lander in the 70s. And basically he became an activist against Forest Service timber sales because there was a timber sale just behind the land where he'd homesteaded, and it destroyed his water supply. And he and I and various other environmentalists used to joke that that was the single most expensive timber sale that the Forest Service ever put out, because it started with him just wanting to protect his own water supply, and he ended up shutting down entire national forest timber sale programs for a while. He was relentless, and it started because he didn't want his backyard. But this is in no human's backyard. And also, we can't, you know, people, one of the reasons that I did not move to Oregon is because when I was thinking about moving, my mom and I drove through Oregon, and there are so many clear cuts, and you can see them. And it's just, I don't want to live in a state like that. And, but this, you can't, nobody can see it from New York City. Nobody can see it from, you know, Crescent City, California. And so they can do whatever crap they want. And so far as most people are concerned, it could be happening on the far side of Jupiter.
Yeah. I mean, the one group of people, I guess, who do consider this to be in their backyard is Pacific Islanders. And there has been a lot of opposition from deep sea mining. And a lot of the countries, there's like 13 countries or something around that number that have declared support for a moratorium or a precautionary pause, or in some cases, an outright ban on deep sea mining. And you'll notice a lot of them are Pacific Islands countries, because they do understand the interconnectivity of the ocean and the fact that something that takes place in the Clarion-Clipperton zone is not going to stay in the Clarion-Clipperton zone. And, you know, realize how dependent they are on the fish that who migrate through these areas. And so, yeah, I mean, that there are, but again, like most people, yeah, living in a city are not, they're yeah, not going to be aware at all. I mean, most people have no idea that this is coming. And, you know, I've done a little bit to try and get the word out there and like writing about it and made a short film about deep sea mining and the impact that it could have. But I think it's still a relatively unknown issue. There have been some articles lately as it's gearing up to begin that are in some of the bigger newspapers. But yeah, it's this weird thing. And, you know, we have the High Seas Treaty that just went in, and people have been erroneously claiming that 30% of the ocean is going to be protected because of that treaty. The treaty doesn't actually commit to any percentage of the ocean being protected. But what we had was all of these headlines and all of these NGOs saying, oh, we've got a huge win. We've had a huge victory for the high seas, and all of this protection is coming. And we have this, I think, you know, in the public view of things, this illusion that the ocean is being protected and that we're having these victories. And meanwhile, you know, very quietly in the background, corporations are gearing up to begin the largest and most destructive project that has ever been planned for the high seas, that is deep sea mining. And very few people have heard of it.
Well, thank you for raising this issue so much and for so long now. We're running out of time. So is there anything else you want to say? Well, one, can people find out more about your organization? Two, how can people, I know we painted a pretty bleak picture, but how can people help on try to stop this atrocity? And I guess those are my two final questions.
Okay. Yeah. And because it is so bleak, we need like all the help, and we need it now. So don't be deterred by that. But yeah, so our website is deepseadefenders.org. And yeah, people can find out about the organization there, and definitely, you know, send us an email if you want to get involved and help. We can also connect you with other organizations that are working on this issue, because there's definitely ones that are bigger than us. But yeah, if you want to volunteer or anything like that, yeah, get in touch. And was there another part to your question? No, I think that's it.
You answered them both.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for all your great work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Julia Barnes. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.